Hi, I'm David Manti with Cannabis Equipment News, and with me today is Michael Kahn, President, and John Wani, Director of Business Development with MCR Labs. Thank you very much for joining me today, gentlemen.
Thank you for having us.
Thanks, Dave.
So, Michael, I'd like to start with you. Could you tell me a little bit about MCR Labs and your role in the cannabis industry?
Sure. So we got our start in 2013. My background is from pharmaceutical, just chemistry. I'm a chemist. And we built MCR from scratch back in 2013 and still building it from scratch to this very day. I see our primary role here is as a public health centered laboratory. So we enhance public health by providing accurate and timely testing for our cannabis clients.
Okay. John, you said you've been working together for 7 years now. Have you been here since the start of MCR as well?
So I came on in June of 2014, shortly after the company had started. And so it's been a really nice opportunity for me to see how far we've come and how much we've grown. And just echoing what Mike said in terms of the role we see ourselves playing in terms of protecting the cannabis consumers in whatever state we operate in, but also act as really a partner to all of our clients and any other client who really tests with us to provide them with the guidance, the information, and the data that they really need in order to, you know, help improve their businesses.
Could you tell me what that partnership typically looks like?
Sure. So in your most sort of standard, you know, client laboratory testing relationships, it's we will do the testing on whatever samples you have, you get the data, and then that's basically the end of it. And while we could have done that, we really never took that stance. What we really made an effort to do was to really engage with our clients, have open discussions about their data, and really trying to tie their data to real world applications and what's actually happening in their facilities and trying to contextualize the data in that framework.
So I see that the industry is still really young. Is it kind of that you're growing together with your clients, trying to figure out what they need and what'll be useful to their business?
Yeah, we realize that changes on an ongoing basis, and our clients' needs and our needs and the whole industry's needs evolve as the industry matures. But, you know, our mission of public health doesn't actually change. What we do to achieve public health might change, you know, slightly, depending on our clients' needs. But overall, we want to see fewer contaminants in cannabis products, however that happens.
What sort of contaminants are you finding in products right now?
The whole gamut, really.
Yeah.
Each state is going to have their required suite of testing. But by and large, you're looking at a lot of similar crossover between the regulatory bodies. So we're looking at microbiological contaminants, whether it's bacteria or molds, heavy metals, which has gained a lot of notoriety over the last, 5 years. In terms of the importance of running that screen for cannabis, along with pesticides, residual solvents on any concentrates, and then, you know, going back to cannabinoid data, which is the basis of how people dose, how the entities, you know, create products, so on and so forth, and really what drives the market, right?
What are you finding in samples? What's different in terms of what you're finding in samples now versus 7-8 years ago?
So we just looked at this data, interestingly enough, it's kind of serendipitous. And what we're seeing is a relative consistent pass rate over the last 3 to 4 years. At the same time, our volume has gone up, you know, exponentially in that same time frame. So what we're seeing is more product that is actually able to pass. I think, I mentioned, Dave, the heavy metal screen. Many growers, unless they really came up in this nascent industry in a regulated market, they're not going to really have baselines in terms of what the metals counts for arsenic, cadmium, mercury, and lead would be in their product. So I think initially when a lot of people started out, since that's such a novel screen for cannabis, there was a good amount of troubleshooting that had to take place there in terms of Is it coming from our nutrients? Is it coming from the soil? Is it coming from our water? And again, engaging with us and trying to allow us to impart as much anecdotal information to help them, you know, move past that issue that they had.
Do you help the clients, Michael, do you guys help the clients with that traceability, trying to trace it back to the source of what's causing the contaminant? And do you help your clients at all with remediation?
So we don't directly help them. So we don't consult for our clients. We do help them, and we leverage our expertise as much as we can. We just never charge them for it, and we never get into a direct relationship where we feel that too close of a relationship with our clients could be disadvantageous for everybody involved, right? It could have the appearance of impropriety, even if there isn't any. So we do have a more formal relationship, but we do also try to prevent problems as much as possible. And we tend to advise our clients where, you know, try this and try a few different things. And these are the most common sources of contamination, or these are the following three root causes that we've observed, you know, elsewhere for this same problem, that sort of thing. So we help them, but we don't come in there and consult for them.
Is a lot of your business, do a lot of your new clients come to you via word of mouth, or how do people find you?
It's sort of a blend in terms of targeted acquisition, but also organic word of mouth growth. If you're in the business for as long as we have been in this state, I mean, we were operational before there was even a functional medical marijuana program. We've really made it a point to strive to hit a few key, you know, indicators that we will never really sacrifice on. And some of the big ones are the data cannot be questioned whatsoever. Accuracy, integrity of the data is the number one thing in this laboratory, and it is something that we will never sacrifice on no matter what. In addition to that is trying to have the highest level of customer service possible. And that's something that I myself am not willing to compromise on. And I know that's, you know, basically espoused throughout the whole organization as well.
Very good. Very good. I just think, customer service for a while was something that just kind of, was kind of going along the wayside as everything sort of went more automated. And, I think that just made a really apparent, there's a really apparent need for it and value to it. So it's good to hear that it's encouraging.
Yeah. And Dave, if I can just add one thing, because the industry is so novel and new, we looked at it as sort of a great educational opportunity for us. And mm-hmm. So whatever events we could go to, whatever speaking engagements we could go to, whoever we could collaborate on and really sort of promote the idea of education in this field, because it was severely needed. It's something that I think will bear fruit in terms of the education and the overall knowledge level for your average consumer being raised up, which is beneficial to everyone in the industry.
Yeah. What initially brought you to the industry, John?
I was a huge pothead and I was enamored with the fact that you could have this plant produce such a wide variety of chemotypes, and you know, which would lead to a whole host of experiences for the user, right? Mm-hmm. And I was taking classes at BU with the intention of perhaps going to either medical or dental school, and I needed some outside sort of experience. And by luck, I found Mike. I found MCR Labs, and it's been my career ever since.
Mike, why the switch from the pharmaceutical industry?
Oh man. Where do I begin? I don't think I've entirely switched. First of all, the pharmaceutical industry and the cannabis testing industry, I don't even call it an industry. They're not that different. We are still accurately measuring important things that are important to measure. But that said, you know, I was really inspired by a colleague of mine, a former colleague of mine from pharma, who was a veteran and a fierce advocate for the right of patients to use, you know, medical cannabis, and it just kind of rolled from there. It was, you know, the patients really did inspire me to try to build this lab, mm-hmm. along with everybody else. That, you know, I did not build it myself. I just want to be very clear about that. This is a team effort.
No, it's interesting because your two stories really blend well with what I hear from everybody. It's either a deep admiration and growing up as a user, or, you know, as a result of kind of like a greater good, seeing the impact that it has, and, you know, so many different people throughout the community.
Yep.
And I think if I could just add on to that, when we first started, like I said, there was no operational industry. And so mm-hmm. our clients were, you know, the parents with a sick child who they're trying to develop, you know, custom formulations in order to help alleviate their symptoms. Someone who themselves is fighting a condition with really no outside help whatsoever, right? And for, I know for myself, and I know for Mike, really, those stories and being able to play a very small role in helping these people acquire the data that they needed, because what are we talking about at the end of the day? These are human beings that are trying to achieve a higher quality of life, right? Mm-hmm. So it was very, very, I want to say, fulfilling for myself and for Mike and for Scott when we were first getting the company going. And that has not dissipated whatsoever. I still get that feeling every time we know that we can help somebody, you know, deliver that data to them that's going to end up helping them.
You keep talking about the data that's going to help people, and I know that it's probably a wide range, but could you talk a little bit specifically about what the data is that people are looking for? Like, you know, you used the case example about the mother or the parents treating the kid. What sort of specific things do people have in mind when they're coming to you? What are they looking for?
Sure. Well, I mean, it's different. Probably it's changed over time, first of all. I want to be very clear about that, but I could think of some examples. I remember, you know, a mother with a sick kid would come in and say, like, the doctor recommended that I give her, say, 1-to-1 THC to CBD or at the following dose, say 50 milligrams per day or whatever it was. At the time, there were no dispensaries, and there was no way for them to take to get there without some analytical support. So, you know, we had the tools and the expertise that are really necessary to get that done. How do you get there, right? Well, we knew a lot of people in the industry, so we can connect the right people together that needed the right kind of medicine. And second of all, we could help them figure out what they do have. And then, you know, I've been a math teacher before. I can help them with the math on how to actually get that final, take that final step from data to administration of a dose, right? I'm not a doctor, so this would always be done with a consultation between them, you know, the patient and their doctor. But they were always missing that analytical piece of, like, well, you might recommend that many milligrams, but how in the world do I get there? And we have the tools for that.
Okay.
And just Dave, just build off that. I'm sorry. This one example that Mike brought up is the one that I often tell, because it shows where we still need to go in terms of research. And a lot of what's happening at sort of that grassroots level in terms of people trying to create products for themselves or someone else, it's trial and error, right? Mm-hmm. It's trial and error. It's formulating, it's experimenting. And I hate using that word, because experimenting in this context is essentially on a living human being. Mm-hmm. But with this specific sort of parental unit, they really worked with us over the course of, I want to say, over a year, and went back and forth with several different iterations of different formulations. And I think they finally settled on a 2-to-1 THCA to CBD ratio for these mm-hmm. tinctures. So both non-psychoactive compounds that they were giving. And then when we were able to, the next test we were able to provide to them was heavy metals. So lead is a neurotoxin, right? It's a neurodegenerative. Obviously, a young child developing brain, especially one who might be already experiencing neurocognitive issues, right?
Right.
Last thing we want to do is introduce another foreign substance that could further exacerbate the issue, right? So as soon as we got that heavy metal screen up and running, we were able to offer that to this family as well, just for a little bit more peace of mind. So the first part with cannabinoids, how do we dose? The second part with the safety screens, I just want to, you know, make sure that I'm not further sickening my child. And again, you know, trying to offer just as much data, which is information, as possible, relevant data.
You've mentioned the tools that you guys use. Could you talk a little bit about the tools and processes in your labs that you use to, you know, find this data?
Sure. I mean, first of all, it varies from test to test to test. But overall, you know, you start with a sample. You know, we have at this point a lot of trained professionals that know how to handle that sample. They would weigh it out. They would extract the analytes. So an analyte is what you're actually looking for. That might be, you know, THC and other cannabinoids, or it might be terpenes, or it could be lead or pesticides or what have you. So you have an extraction step. Then we have these calibrated pipetters for dilutions. Some of this process is automated with robots at this point. And then we have a whole array of different instruments that can measure the amounts of the various analytes in the sample that we just extracted. It does vary, but we, you know, one thing that doesn't vary is that we always use an, you know, external certified reference materials to calibrate our samples against. Okay. So the point is that we're not a dark box where sample goes in and data comes out. We compare everything that we do to the outside world. We are ISO 17025 accredited, which means we, you know, every machine that we have, every tool, every instrument is calibrated against external to us calibrators.
Okay. Do you, how many labs do you have in Massachusetts right now? And do you guys only work with the medical part of the industry?
We have one lab in Massachusetts, and now we work with adult use as well as medical.
Okay. And part of the reason I wanted to reach out was because you guys had some pretty big news recently. You just branched out with a new lab in Pennsylvania, correct?
Yeah.
Could you tell me a little bit about that expansion and some of your expectations moving into a new market?
Sure. Yeah, we're very excited. We have a great team in Pennsylvania. This is an important step for us because we believe we can bring, you know, our knowledge base, our expertise to the Pennsylvania Medical Marijuana Program, and we can really make a big difference there. So we're all very excited about it.
Okay. John, is part of the plan expanding further? And with such expansion, especially with things only being legal state to state, is there a lot of sort of due diligence before you open a new lab because sort of the rules are different everywhere you go?
You hit the nail on the head, Dave. So what we are looking at are moves in terms of prudent expansion. When we were analyzing the Pennsylvania market, obviously we look at, you know, geography relative to Massachusetts within our sort of region, if you want to call it, you know, mid-Atlantic tri-state, up into New England. Pennsylvania had really the most robust and more mature market just in terms of, you know, producers. They actually had testing regulations, and, you know, the size of the market was there. But you're absolutely right. We are looking to perhaps move into other states, but it's going to be done with and it's going to be accomplished in a very calculated manner. We have an advanced team that's going to be looking at, you know, certain markets. We're going to look at all of these different variables and indicators, and then discuss as a team, really. And that's one of the things about this group working at MCR is the collaborative nature is highly productive. And rarely do decisions get made in a vacuum. And I think what you find is a lot of buy-in once those decisions happen, and then everybody's behind it 100%.
Can you only service the state that you're in, or can you service? Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. So, well, the limitation is that cannabis cannot cross state border. Yeah. That's a federal offense. And the only thing that seems to be, even what we do within a state is technically federally illegal, right? Mm-hmm. However, we are compliant with all state requirements and regulations, and we think that we're doing good. We're doing the right thing by helping to reduce the contaminants in these products. So we stand by that. This is just something that needs to happen. Mm-hmm. No, but we draw the line. We do not accept samples from out of state. We don't test for anybody out of state. We'd have to go there.
Okay. I read that you guys are processing 10,000 samples every month. Or is that already old news? Is it higher than that already?
10,000 might be a little bit of a stretch. We're close to that number. We are running way more actual analyses than that, right?
Okay.
So the proper statistic would probably be we are running tens of thousands of tests a month. Okay. But like I said, our volume has grown every year since the industry really opened up in 2015. And we sort of build this in terms of how we scale and how we hire and how we build out for the future, because this goes back to one of your first questions in terms of really how do we look at ourselves, in terms of our role in the industry. And we really look at our role in Massachusetts, along with any other state that we operate in, to be, open and honest players, who are really here for the long haul. We are not here for a short play. We're really here to build a name for ourselves around the idea that you will not get back data that is any more accurate than you can from MCR. And at the same time, you're never going to reach the level of customer service.
Okay. John, do clients find you before they launch a product and they're trying to test it before it goes to market? Or are you typically being found by clients after the product's already on the market?
So, in mass, it's done with vertical integration in mind.
Okay.
So each individual entity that produces product, they basically have to start producing product at step one, right? Mm-hmm. And this is for everyone. The only places that would be able to essentially retail cannabis products without producing themselves are retail licenses. And we don't really have any relationship with them. Let me take that back, Dave. We don't have a regulatory relationship with these retail onlys, but okay. We've gone out of our way to essentially show them that we are here as a tool. We hosted an event at our laboratory late in 2019, where we had a bunch of these economic or social equity retail only, providers come in and just give an informational session to their front of the house staff, so they could get a better idea of, hey, these are some of the questions that you might see in terms of product. This is how to interpret a lab report. So you can, convey that information correctly to a customer if they might be asking. But your original question, they'll come to us sometimes before they make a product, sometimes when they are developing it, but also they might come to us after it's been fully developed and they just, they want to get the data on the back end just to make sure that their process is working.
Has there ever been a time where you sort of stopped a company from a product launch because there might've been a couple of red flags that needed to be worked out?
Yes. And I say that very, very, very quickly, just from the standpoint of, and not a product being made, but Mike and I have discouraged certain clients from using really volatile solvents.
Okay.
That most other states, the operators there wouldn't even think about using them. And I'm talking about rather volatile class two solvents, not class threes, but class two solvents that whether it's, OSHA or EPA, they have very, very low tolerances in terms of how long a human being can be exposed to them. So sometimes you might have someone like Mike, who's got a really, really strong background in education and science and chemistry, namely, and can look at the solvent list and say, maybe I'll start using chloroform to extract my cannabis products. And then we have to have a, just, you know, an open conversation about what are the pros and what are the cons, right? And namely, one of the big cons is from a marketing perspective, right? Mm-hmm. How the hell are you going to sell that product?
Yeah. Yeah.
When chloroform was the extraction solvent. And Mike might have a couple of other stories as well about that.
Yeah. My biggest contribution on this is finally, really, there's a safe way to make these products. There are, so in this case, we have cannabinoids, which is the active set of ingredients from cannabis, right? And then whenever you make a chocolate or a tincture or a concentrate or anything else, you may be adding inactive ingredients, which are called excipients. There are excipients that are safe for ingestion. There are excipients that are safe for inhalation. There are excipients that are safe for all sorts of routes of administration. But, you know, you have to really know what you're doing, because just because something is safe for ingestion does not mean that it's safe for inhalation. And vice versa, right? You have to really understand the product that you're making. And this is what really led to that vaping crisis about a year and a bit ago. And really what it comes down to, I think, is people aren't tapping into the well-established, you know, formulation databases and knowledge bases that the pharmaceutical industry has been operating from for years, right? Mm-hmm. It doesn't mean that, you know, I'm not saying that pharmaceutical sciences have an answer to everything. They don't, obviously, but what I am saying is that it's a better place to start than from nothing, right? And I encourage the commission in Massachusetts and other regulators to look at the broader literature and recommend, you know, the FDA has a safe excipient database, right? These are the things that are considered safe for inhalation. There's a solid 100 of them, right, that you can use. Just choose from a safer list than whatever's in your head, right? Use that list. Please publish that list. So really, yeah, I just anybody who's watching, anybody who's listening, I encourage to seek the literature out there. It's not that complicated. It's just the FDA excipient database.
Do you think it's because so many people get into this business without any previous experience, even running a business, let alone in the cannabis business, why sometimes those steps are missed or not taken?
Possibly. I mean, that's a part of it, right? But I don't think it's all of it. If you have just a little bit of knowledge, that's even more dangerous, because you think you know what you're doing, but you really are doing something dangerous. I just wish, you know, yes, those people, that's going to happen anywhere, but the regulators at this point, I think it's on, the responsibility is on them to provide these businesses with some blueprint, some pathway towards safe products, right? Mm-hmm. You know, the first time, sure, nobody knew what was, you know, that anybody was going to do this. But like, looking at it, hindsight is, you know, if they were provided with a safe process for making their products, or some guidelines on how to safely produce these products, hopefully, you know, they would have never resorted to something unsafe.
Did you mention that you are working with regulators on developing standards?
No, I didn't mention it, but I, you know, I'm always open, and I have, and I will continue to do so. And okay. Yeah. So yes, I do routinely do so, and I continue to offer that whenever whoever's interested. Yeah.
I think that's a big underrated part in terms of how either successful or unsuccessful regulatory bodies are in individual states, on how much they query and collaborate with the laboratories that they're working with, because we are, in effect, doing the work on the ground, right? And we're getting our hands dirty, and we're seeing the live samples and the issues that might come up. So just to touch what Mike said on the vitamin E acetate scare that happened in 2019, we moved very quickly to develop our own internal screen, which we did in about, I want to say, 10 days, 14 days, fully validated, and then offered it to anybody else for free if they wanted to run it as well, because this was so much information coming out at once nobody really had enough solid data or time to really parse through it and figure out what the hell is actually going on. But let's just act cautious in this time frame. Let's develop the screen. Let's start screening for it. And then we can figure this stuff out on the back end, right? I think what we saw was nobody in our legal market in Massachusetts was using vitamin E acetate. But it did shine a light on another aspect of the testing process that was not being taken into account before, which was the delivery device for these vapes, the actual hardware themselves, right? And so we're going to make the operators in Massachusetts jump through hoops to make sure that the flower and the concentrate is as clean as possible, but we don't care about the delivery device that you're going to put this now clean oil into. And I think we've, you know, the state recognized that, and then they made a quick change, which is now all vapes that get submitted to MCR or any other laboratory have to be filled. Mm-hmm. We can't just receive the oil pre-fill. We have to receive them post-fill and test the oil out of the cartridge. So,
okay. You know, with nearly a decade of experience testing this plant, you know, how has it helped grow your understanding of some of the benefits and, you know, maybe some of the things that you guys didn't know about it going in?
Sure. John, I have something to say here.
Yeah, I'll take that first. Okay. Like I had mentioned, Dave, initially my main interest in cannabis was essentially the varietals. Mm-hmm. And how much diversity that you could have in basically one genus. What I've learned over the years is it is quite a bit more complex than I even anticipated. Mm-hmm. And there is so much polyhybridization that's happened up until this point in terms of genetics. It's one of those things where names really mean little in today's day and age. What really matters is the chemical profile, the chemotype of the plant, right? You can call something one thing, but if the chemical profile is not what someone else would expect, right? I mean, I'm going to bring up the classic example, Blue Dream. I don't think you find anybody that smoked weed that probably hasn't come across Blue Dream at one point. There are so many Blue Dreams that we have tested of varying cannabinoid and terpene profiles. That really, I think what you're going to see is a push away from the classic sativa indica hybrid classifications, and really one more towards, you know, data and approach in terms of this is how much of X that I want, right? So yeah, for me, that definitely was a big eye opener, and I'm still learning about it, right? I'm still acquiring knowledge.
Okay. Mike, what'd you want to say on it?
Yeah, it's such a different approach from what I was used to in pharma previously to this. It was pharma was very structured, very, you know, you have this molecule. Step one is to get it into, you know, simulated fluids to see how it reacts, and then you go into phase one clinical trials, phase two, phase three clinical trials. And so on. And it's, you know, you're really looking for the effect of the one molecule on the, generally on the one condition, or maybe it's, you know, overall well-being, but really it's just one molecule at a time, and you're really formulating it from a powder. And what we have here, right, and that was medicine. That's how medicine is made in the pharmaceutical industry. And here we have something that's starting from the opposite side, right? Where you have a whole bunch of conditions, and you have, you know, anecdotal evidence of these plants seeming to treat these conditions. And then we know that the plants have many, many, many more different molecules that may or may be responsible for some of the effects. Some of the conditions respond to some of these molecules, probably, possibly, right? The whole experience, the whole transition was really eye-opening, right? Because why should it be one molecule? Like, life isn't that simple, right? Mm-hmm. Well, we have so many receptors. We have so many different things going on in our bodies all at once. And to think that one molecule will really solve these problems is kind of looking back, like, why would we? Sometimes it works, but it's just a completely opposite approach to medicine, right? Mm-hmm. That was very eye-opening for me.
Yeah, and Mike just jogged my memory a little bit. I'm sorry, but I need to bring this up. Whenever we're discussing with someone just the process of decarboxylation, right, the conversion of an acidic cannabinoid into its activated cannabinoid, so THCA to delta 9 conversion, you could probably find it very quickly, Dave, with you and your team, in terms of this picture from I think it's the Journal of Russian Pharmacology. It's like 1991, very, very old picture. And it's going to plot out essentially over time and temperature how long you would need to heat up at what temp to achieve full decarboxylation of THCA, right? Mm-hmm. Just like Mike mentioned, cannabis doesn't just produce THCA, right? And if we are going to extract all of the various phytochemicals that cannabis produces into now a new matrix, we can't use this old information. We can use it as a baseline to start, you know, in terms of experimentation, but don't look at the 237 degrees at 20 minutes going to achieve 80% decarboxylation, because not only is there a bunch of THCA in this newly formed matrix, but there are a ton of other compounds that are all going to play a role in how that molecule interacts, or the molecules interact with heat, right? And so the activation energy might be, you know, you might need a little bit more activation energy in this instance, rather than just looking at some literature and coming it up, you know, on paper.
Okay. So I read that you were the first independent cannabis testing lab in Massachusetts. Is that correct?
It goes back. We were just talking with Joe about this. And okay. I believe we were the first cannabis testing laboratory to test samples in the state late November, December, 2013. Okay. In terms of, were we the first incorporated? Were we the first to open our doors? I don't think those.
Don't know.
Yeah, we it's too hard to really.
Okay.
You know.
Well, what is the okay. We can work with probably. what is the competitive landscape look like for you guys?
Yeah, we have colleagues at several other labs in Massachusetts. We have a good working relationship with those that we've known for a while, and we've learned to like and to trust each other. But it's, you know, it's probably like any other state. There are plenty of labs and plenty of good scientists around, and we have a collaborative relationship.
Okay.
If anything, I know Mike and I and a couple of our colleagues have been anticipating more laboratories opening up, mm-hmm. namely because we truly view our success being tied with the industry's success, right? Mm-hmm. If more labs coming online is going to allow more operators to get results more quickly to really drive sales, then it's going to help us out in the long run, because the industry is going to be able to mature that much quicker. Right.
Okay.
And we have never really shied away from any competition whatsoever. We will work with anybody who reaches out. But we are, you know, really solely focused on our clients and trying to do as best as we can delivering our services.
Well, a little bit on that note, how was your 2020 with the pandemic and everything? From what I saw, it looked like you still had a pretty strong year, but not as good as 2019.
No, it was better than 2019, but not. It's been a really hard year for almost everybody in the world, right? Yeah. And us included. And we've had to make sacrifices, of course. Our employees' safety has always been our top priority, and it continues to be our top priority. And you know, we couldn't possibly continue to provide, you know, analytical testing services without, you know, our employees, who are really the backbone of everything that we do. So yes, we've had to cut back in certain ways, but we were able to make it through without layoffs, without any, you know, pay cuts or any of that. We've been planning for this sort of thing. And we believe that our responsibility is to our organization, you know. So yes, it's been difficult, but in the same way that it's been difficult, I'm sure, for you and for everybody that you know, right?
We're not. Oh, yeah. Yeah, yeah, no.
If I could just add on to that, the fact that we were able to get through the year, and I know, and it's one of those things where, you know, arbitrary benchmark, like December 31st, 2020, it's not like the stuff's going to go away, right?
Right.
But I am very proud to work at a company that, like Mike said, we did not furlough anyone. We did not have a freezing hire. We there was a lot of uncertainty, Dave, as I'm sure you know, in March and April into May of last year. Our volume did take a precipitous hit, and we didn't know at that time if it was going to recover, if the industry was going to recover. There were a lot of unknowns, but we made the conscious decision, even if it could potentially have hurt the company, to really, you know, stick with the hiring, stick with getting more equipment on board, and, you know, considering the you know, the organization that you work for, this laboratory equipment is not cheap. Right. Mm-hmm. So it's quite the commitment in terms of, you know, we might have to buy another triple quad, right? Mm-hmm. In the middle of the pandemic with our volume down 30%. So, right. The fact that not only were we able to stay open, we didn't have any wide scale, you know, closures. We really didn't disturb or inhibit the industry from moving forward. I think the one thing that we saw was a bit of an increase in our turnaround times, but that's something I was willing to live with, and Mike was willing to live with, because frankly, we were trying to keep our staff safe, and we weren't going to do anything in terms of trying to change any processes or strive for more efficiency in turnaround times if that meant jeopardizing our staff or jeopardizing anybody who was going to come into the laboratory, including our clients who were dropping off, you know, samples and stuff like that. So very, very proud of the fact that we did more business 20 versus 19. It might not have been as much as 19 versus 18, but again, with all of the, you know, circumstances taken under consideration, I'm very, very proud of where we are right now.
How many employees do you guys have on staff?
I think right now we are
over 100.
Yeah,
it's really hard to
110, I want to say, in Massachusetts.
Oh, okay. Okay. So what are your and I understand that there's so much unknown right now, but, you know, kind of after everything was disrupted last year, what are your expectations for this year?
We'll see. I'm not going to make predictions. Not after 2020.
I do have one slight prediction in terms of states that are on the fence with a medical program thinking about going adult use recreation, or maybe states that are on the fence about getting a medical program online. Most of the country, in terms of fiscal budgets, we're going to see shortfalls. And Pennsylvania is a really, really nice example of Republican governor, basically Republican, you know, Congress and House within the state, Democratic lieutenant governor, right? Everyone's basically coming together and saying, we already have the infrastructure. We already have this medical market. Why not open it up recreationally, right? Mm-hmm. And I think that the unintended sort of thing that COVID caused was for a lot of legislators to reconsider how they stand in this aspect, right?
Okay.
And that, no, maybe it's not the devil's lettuce and it's going to come and steal your children and cause, you know, everything to go, you know, hell in a handbasket style. I don't think that's the case. I think if you look at the mature markets like Washington State, Oregon State, Colorado, I know California is the oldest of the bunch, but they basically just got put on to, you know, their seed to sale tracking with the Bureau of Cannabis Control, right? So really, I look at Colorado and Washington that show you can have a legal market. It can be run by professionals. You can tax and regulate it in a sensible manner. You can use those tax revenues to fund things, you know, within your communities that actually need it. And to just take this negative stigma away from people are going to get hurt, it's going to lead to other things. The data just doesn't bear out those falsities.
Okay. Is federal legalization feasible in the next 4 years?
I don't know, man.
So
feasible, yeah, of course it's feasible, but I don't know what that looks like.
Feasible, yes. Applicable or practical, who knows?
We're a bunch of scientists. We're not political operatives. We don't really know.
You guys are in the data. You know.
But you know, if now we're talking about, you know, potentially hiring lobbyists or getting someone down to DC and then, you know, getting in touch. And that's just getting us away from our wheelhouse. That's not what we're comfortable with. We're really not, you know, set up to be that type of organization to lobby or push for regulatory change, especially such a drastic one like that. What I do think is going to happen, though, not only from a financial perspective, but also from a criminal justice perspective, social equity perspective, I just think that there's a lot of positive momentum that's happening. But I think my face and Mike's face on your initial question, you know, should tell you all, with our industry, there's so many unknowns that it's almost like if I can get a snapshot into the next 6 months, maybe a year, that's awesome. Right.
Yeah. I mean, there are a lot of things that I believe should happen, but are they going to happen? I have no idea. You know, there's things in Washington run by their own schedule. And I just, you know, we'll see. I don't even know what that'll look like. I mean, there's things that I think should be done just because they're the right thing to do. And I, you know, we're going to be here to help create a safer environment, whatever they decide to do. Just give us, you know, a heads up if you hear about it.
Is there anything else that we might have left out or anything in particular that you want the CEN audience to know about MCR?
If I could just say, Mike touched on it initially, but one of the things that I also did not have the firmest grasp of was the accreditation process, what that means, and not only what that process looks like, but also who conducts your accreditation, who is your auditing body, right? There are options out there that really are set up for labs that don't want to challenge themselves. We chose ANAB to be our accrediting body, which is not the easy way out. And you know, to go through full ISO IEC 17025 accreditation to the 2017 standard, which was updated, obviously 2017, shows that our main prerogative is integrity of the data and traceability of the data. Because when we talk to clients about this, we want to be able to take away any issues that they might have, any apprehensions, any anxieties that they might have, because I think what you've seen, and I hate to bring this up, but when labs don't operate, you know, above board and they start doing shady things that they really shouldn't, the lab's going to get in trouble, most likely shut down, right? They're going to go away. You'll probably never even think twice about them. But the fallout has to be dealt by the clients, by the operators. The industry in general gets hurt because there's a lack of confidence now from a consumer standpoint, right? So why would I have to go to this place and pay a tax on something when I can go down the street to my buddy's house and get it for about, you know, a third of the price? Well, that's what we're all trying to really get towards in these mature regulated markets, right? If there's integrity in the product and the consumer can trust the industry, then we're really going to get going here, right? I don't think you'll find somebody that says, yeah, I don't trust the ABV on my Budweiser, so I'm going to go run a test at home. It is what it is, right?
Yeah. Well, I mean, talking about alcohol, I mean, I still have a few friends that like to make it in their basement. It doesn't mean that I'm going to drink it after softball. Absolutely. It means that I'm going to run away from it and never have it near an open flame.
Absolutely.
Okay. Well, I want to thank you both very much for taking the time today. I really do appreciate it. And I think there's a lot for our readers to unpack here. I say readers, even though they're either watching or listening. I'm just stuck in the old media.
Yeah, I still read.
I still read too.
Hey, very good. Very good. Well, thanks again, you guys. I really appreciate it.
Thanks for your time. It was fun.
Thank you, David. Thank you for everything.